Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You are listening to Claret and Blue, an Aston Villa podcast brought to you by Birmingham Live.
Hello and welcome to the latest instalment of Claret and Blue podcast. We're super excited today because don't want to embarrass the guy, but we've got a bona fide, genuine Aston Villa legend joining us today. Gareth Barry, how are you, Gareth?
Hi, Matt. Very good, thank you. Nice to be speaking to you today.
So let's take you way back when. Let's start at the very beginning to when you first fell in love with football as a boy. Yeah. Can you remember how it came about? Is your dad a sporting guy?
Yeah, my dad was a sort of a good footballer at his level back in the day. He was a Brighton schoolboy. And then I've got three older brothers as well, so it was sort of plenty of action in the garden, pestering the old man to get out there every day after work and, sort of learning your trade in the garden as a young kid. So, there's plenty of football going on in the Barry household.
So what was that like then with three older brothers? Did you have to kind of prove yourself kind of physically as well? Or?
Yeah, I think as a younger sibling, it sort of holds you in good stead, doesn't it? It sort of gets you ready for them tougher battles because you're used to them growing up. So I definitely feel that was a big part of sort of your learning curve as a young kid growing up. So yeah, thankful to the older bros too.
you realise that you had a love for it and a natural ability for it, and you were pushing your dad to get you to join a team, or was it the other way around? Or
yeah, it was just a love for football. Speaking to my mum, she would always tell me you wouldn't go anywhere without the football stuck under your arm. You know, whether you're in the garden, walking down the street, in the swing park, I always had a ball with me. So yeah, as a young kid, certainly in my era growing up, it was any spare time you got the football out, had a kick around with your mates, and even if it's on your own, you're kicking it against the wall. So they were memories of me being a youngster, definitely. Remember, I went and played an age group up, so it must have been under eights, and I was, or under nines, and I was as a year below. And actually, remember the opposition complaining that I wasn't old enough to be playing. So that was my first real game, if you like, and had people complaining there. So I'm not sure why they were complaining. I must have had a good game.
So obviously the first, three or four years, maybe more of your professional career, played as a centre-half, played as a full-back. As a kid, was there a position that you kind of made your own when you were first playing football?
Yeah, I was always a centre midfielder. Now and again, I'd play on left midfield as coming through like the district and county, and now and again for Brighton and Hove Albion as a schoolboy, I'd play left midfield, but generally, I was centre midfielder. That's where I always felt comfortable as a young kid. And you want to be involved in the games as much as possible. And centre midfield was certainly where I felt more comfortable. Certainly growing up.
And what age were you when kind of Brighton came knocking then?
I was 9 or 10. I remember. as a scout in Hastings, who actually, you know, lived quite close to where my family home was. He come down and sort of said, "Would you like to go and train at Brighton?" Sort of, it's once a week. So they had a school of excellence, they used to call it back then. They had half of the group from Sussex that lived in that sort of Hastings way, sort of East Sussex. They were training Eastbourne, and the other side were training Brighton. So yeah, once a week I'd go and train in Eastbourne, and then if you were getting selected, you playing the games at the weekend. So yeah, that was my first real experience of, you know, getting into the real football world.
Always struck me as a real level-headed bloke. Did your parents kind of just warn you, you know, to make sure that you're doing your kind of maths homework and you do you know what I mean? A safety net, really, or was everything football?
They were quite keen on me to still keep the schoolwork ticking over. They could tell my main drive, even from 10 or 11, was desperate to play football. So they would have known that, but yeah, they wouldn't have been happy if I was slacking too much on the schoolwork, but you know, they were fantastic. I think for any parent, you know, they deserve a lot of credit for young kids wanting to play football. You know, I think back now on the amount of time they've taken out from work and, you know, driving me around the whole country, you know, takes a lot of time and effort from them.
What was it they did for a living, Gareth?
So my dad was a plumber, and there were six of us in the Barry household, so the mum was a full-time mum.
So do you think if that left foot hadn't been quite as sweet, do you think you could be kind of sorting out stopcocks and leaky taps and stuff like that?
Well, I've got a story. Where you do your work experience at school, I was keen to go with my dad and have a week with him, you know, see what the plumbing was all about. And I think I lasted about a day and a half. So I don't think the plumbing was ever going to be my thing anyway. So the answer to the question is a definite no.
You know, you're a teenager still when you're with Brighton. How all of a sudden do you end up kind of moving, you know, a couple of hundred miles and ending up at Aston Villa? What was the process that brought you to Villa?
Yeah, so strangely enough, there was a Alfie Apps. He's quite a well-known sort of younger a scout, and he came from just outside Hastings, and you know, Hastings generally is a sort of a tough part of the country to sort of get out of there, and you know, especially in terms of football. He was working, doing bits with Brian Jones and Aston Villa, and you know, he was pushing for me to the Villa people that, you know, there's a good young player down in Hastings, you know, currently with Brighton. So it was him, really, the connection that you know, sort of brought Aston Villa towards me. You know, my game really, really improved from the ages of 15 to 16. You know, I went from being at Brighton, sort of, you know, one of the better players, not the best, one of the better players, to all of a sudden Aston Villa were interested. And the last year at school, all of a sudden I had three or four London clubs too that were really keen for me to sign, which was back then YTS form. So yeah, I finished my GCSEs and I had, all of a sudden, had four or five, you know, professional clubs that, you know, wanted me to go and sign for them.
Can you remember who the clubs were and what it was about Villa that gave them the edge?
Yeah, it was Chelsea, Arsenal, Crystal Palace. Obviously, you had Brighton, the option to stay there too. But, you know, I had a week sort of training up at Bodymore Heath. It must have been an Easter half or one of the half terms. I remember coming up with J. Lloyd Samuel. We were in shared digs together for a week. So I had a good feeling for the place straight away. So looking back, I think that week training there and getting to know the surroundings and the players that were around sort of, you know, sort of really helped. But yeah, it was a tough decision. I think my parents were quite heavy in the end in terms of what they felt. They didn't really fancy me going to London. They felt I might be wanting to come home every other weekend, whereas if I was 200 miles away, I had to stay there and concentrate on my football. So, yeah, looking back, it was a great move for me.
What's that like then? Because I presume you hadn't spent a great deal of time away from home until that.
No, it was very daunting. I've not mentioned Michael Standen yet. He was a Brighton kid with me at the time, and he was sort of one of the best players in England, playing for England schoolboys. I think him and Joe Cole were the two main men in England, and he had probably the choice of the whole country of where he could have gone and played football, and he ended up choosing Villa too. So that made that initial move so much easier that I knew someone quite well, and I was going straight into digs with them. So, you know, me and Michael forged a great sort of friendship living in the digs in Sutton Coldfield for 2 years.
It's interesting you mention those digs, because we've been able to go through our picture archives, and we found an absolutely brilliant picture.
I'm not sure you're the one, I think.
There's that. I think that's you, Michael. Who's the guy in the middle, Gareth?
That's David Burks. He was that was our second year. So David was a year younger. I knew the picture because I could never get away from that Deodora t-shirt I've got on.
Tell us what it was like then. Did she become a kind of second mum in a way? You know, was it strict house rules or?
Yeah, Jill Jones was her name, and this was probably her 10th or 11th year. So she's seen a lot of players come through there, you know. Probably the majority don't go on and make it Aston Villa. So she was very, very experienced, and sort of that house was perfect for how you were, how you wanted to, you know, live your life away from the training ground. And she did become that sort of motherly feeling around the house, looking after you, making sure you're eating right. And yeah, there were strict rules. I don't think we crossed the line too many times, but yeah, there were certainly rules in place. And if you did, you were getting reported back to the club pretty sharpish.
So while we've mentioned Michael, tell us a little bit about your kind of friendship with him down the years, because obviously he now, you know, for the last, I don't know, decade or so, I think he's represented you as your kind of agent as well as your best mate. Was it strange when you kind of arrived at the same time, and all of a sudden you kind of went on to become this kind of Villa great, and Michael's career didn't work out as planned at Aston Villa? Was that awkward, or you're such good mates that you're able to support each other through the highs and lows? Or
yeah, I think there would have been awkward moments at times, probably for both of us. It'd probably be easier for say it would have been more awkward for Michael, but I think there would have been sort of awkward moments at times, because we've probably joined the club as 16-year-olds with, you know, Michael being the bigger talent and more expected of him, you know, and football, you know, has funny ways of giving different paths to players. I think we both sort of done well, really well initially. But, you know, my game training day in, day out seemed to, you know, really improve. And it didn't take long before I was knocking on the first team's door. Whereas, you know, Michael, he didn't seem to, you know, he's probably not the biggest sort of, you know, sort of physical specimen. He needed to grow. They kept saying, you need to grow, you need to get stronger. Whereas I sort of adapted to the men's game a bit quicker. So that held him back a tiny bit. And looking back, Michael say himself, he probably left the club too early. He probably would have spent another year or two, developed into a man a bit more. And, you know, he may have felt he'd have got another chance.
What was that like being at a football club the size of Villa back then, kind of late 90s? Was it still a case where you'd have to do some of the kind of menial chores and you'd have to clean boots and stuff like that? Was that kind of grounding still in existence then?
Yeah, it was. It was, looking back, it was quite tough going. Just to get to the to Bodymore Heath back then, we had to walk from the digs to the train station. We'd get the train to Witton or Aston, one of them, and then we'd have to walk to Villa Park and then the minibus from Villa Park to Bodymore Heath. So, you know, even before you got into the training ground, you've got a bit of a slap, sort of an hour and a half sort of travel. Yeah, and the jobs were well in place. You got assigned with a job, two of you, and then you had two of the professional players' boots. So back then I was with Simon Grayson, Ricardo Scimeca, them were my two boots that I was cleaning every day and making sure you could see your face in them. So yeah, they were good times really. And when the younger boys now say they don't have to clean them anymore, I think that stuff like that's a bit of a shame.
So did they tip well?
yeah, they tipped all right. They tipped all right. It wasn't too long before I was in the team ahead of them, so they weren't tipping then.
It was a dressing room with a lot of kind of big names and big personalities, wasn't it, that you're going into? There'd have been the likes of, I suppose, Merson would have been around, would he? And Dion Dublin, and like I said, Ian Taylor. What was that like? Were you starstruck at all, or were you just, did you back yourself? Did you get involved in the banter, or how was that kind of transition?
Yeah, it was again, I'm using the word daunting, but you know, I'm training with the first team regularly, probably towards the end of that first year. started traveling with them just to get some experience of being around the team. And, you know, I was comfortable getting changed in the youth team dressing room and then training with the first team and then going back there because, you know, I knew that environment in the dressing room would have been slightly different to what I was used to. So when the manager or whoever was told me time for you to get in the first team dressing room, it was very nerve-wracking, I must admit. You've mentioned some big name players we had around then. It was sort of Bosnich, Dwight York, Southgate, going in there, and I was a very quiet lad as it was, and there wasn't much being said. I was more taking it in as I was getting changed every day.
John Gregory was the man, wasn't he, back then? Yeah. I was going to actually skipped ahead a little bit here, but or missed this out earlier. But do you remember what he said when there was the bit of the compensation wrangle with Brighton? Do you remember his quote?
Yeah. I've got the newspaper cutting somewhere, or my mum will have, with me on the Brighton beach with a seagull on my head and a ball under my arm. So I remember what he said. It was quite clever. It was a typical sort of John Gregory comment. Made a few headlines.
What was it like being the subject of that, though? Because like you say, you're a quiet guy who doesn't really kind of, you know, seek the spotlight, but you'd got this kind of little tug of war with Doug Ellis, you know, traditionally trying to kind of squeeze every last penny and pound. John Gregory wasn't afraid to wear his heart on his sleeve, and you were just probably wants to, you know, get your boots on and play football. Was it a bit of a weird situation being in the middle of all that?
Yeah, it was slightly weird because the tribunal thing and the compensation, it wasn't really known back then. And, you know, the money they were talking about was sort of a lot of money. Brighton were struggling sort of in the now League Two. They were threatening to go out of the league. So the money they were talking was huge for them. But on Villa's side, they were thinking, you know, this isn't normal. Why should we be having to pay so much money for someone that's not played in the first team for Brighton or not even played for the youth team? So it was strange, but because it wasn't, as a young kid, you don't really understand it all. So it was easy for me and Michael was involved in the compensation too. We just got our head down and played football and, you know, had a giggle about it, but didn't pay too much notice to it all. He was a great man, manager, John Gregory. That was definitely one of his strengths. He knew how to treat the individuals differently. As you get more experienced, you realise that a good manager has to do that because, you know, we are all different, all the players, different personalities. And, you know, he was fantastic at what each player needed. So, you know, I owe a lot to John because, you know, he showed a lot of faith in me at a young age to throw me in the first team, not only just throw me in, but, you know, keep me in for a long period of time straight away.
Your debut, I think, came at the age of 17. If my research is correct, came on as a sub at Sheffield Wednesday. By that stage, Gareth, had you already been kind of travelling as kind of, I don't know, as the extra man? Were you used to kind of the match day environment as a Villa youth, if you like?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewellery from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yeah, I think my first experience was actually under Brian Little when he was still there. It was a fixture around Christmas. He just wanted me to travel down on the coach, you know, get used to it. He let me warm up on the pitch with the lads, and from there, I think I went home to spend the Christmas with my family. That was the first year, so I was still 16 then. But you know, once I got to my 17th birthday, I signed professional forms. Started traveling with the team, yeah, and getting used to it. I'd been on the bench a couple of times, and yeah, that Sheffield Wednesday game, I remember it well. You know, I don't remember much of the game because you're running around on sort of nervous energy. Come on, Free and Taylor, we won the game. You know, just delighted at the end of it to have made my debut. And, you know, straight away you've got the taste for it and you just want more.
You never really looked back from that moment, did you? Because I think, you know, come the next season, you were if my memory serves me correctly, you were pretty much a first team regular from then on in. Did it just feel the natural place for you to be?
Yeah, I think there was a bit of luck on along the way, if you like. You know, I actually made my debut in midfield, and the week after my first start against Arsenal, I was starting in midfield as well. Hugo had got sent off at the Arsenal game, I think, if my memory's right. It's a long time ago now, and I had to go back into the back. So, and then the following season was a David Unsworth story. So things sort of went my way, but you know, in football, when they sort of fall your way, you've still got to take the chance, and it was sort of being ready for taking it.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I forgot the Unsworth thing. David Unsworth and his family getting a bit of homesickness was one of those sliding door moments for you, because that would have been his position, wouldn't it, that you made your own?
Yeah, so there would have been doubts about a young kid sort of playing a full season alongside Southgate and Ekiog. So obviously, you know, I knew that. I sort of understood how the game was working already, and Unsworth had been signed to probably play the majority of games. And you know, when all that palaver went on that he didn't realise Birmingham was so far away from Liverpool and stuff like that, you know, I didn't take much notice of it. But, you know, when he eventually left and signed for Everton, there was then talk, who's going to play? So then we still had plenty of options that could have played there back then. The squad was a good one. But, you know, John Gregory probably thought left-footed, Let's throw him in, see how he does at Goodison Park. And yeah, I remember that first game well too. It was a tough game, 0-0 draw. And certainly from that moment on, I didn't look back, because you know, I'd made a steady start, and the confidence just grew and grew after that.
Quiz question for you: can you remember your first Villa goal and who it came against?
Yes, Nottingham Forest, 2-0, was it?
It was, yeah. I can't remember much about it. Talk me through it. Was it down the Holt end or?
No, it was the other end. It was, yeah, I always get confused. I remember my second goal more against, I think it was Charlton, but yeah, it was a cross came in. I must have been playing midfield at this point, because, you know, I wouldn't have been on the back post, and, you know, I find myself in the middle of the 18-yard box. I'm sure Dave Besson's in goal. I just get across the defender and managed to poke it home. So, yeah, I think that was my first goal anyway. Am I right?
No, I think so. Yeah, 2-0.
Yeah. I don't. 22 years ago, are we talking?
Yeah, it's a while ago. Yeah. You know, you've never really kind of mastered your own kind of celebration, have you? It's always been a kind of like a two hands raised or a one hand point or something like that.
Yeah.
You've been understated.
I think so, yeah. I would never have dreamt of making a celebration up. I don't think that's in my nature. So, obviously, to score a goal, you're having that buzz for 10, 15 seconds. So, yeah, it wasn't certainly a natural thing that came my way. So, and there was a few goals over the years in the end, so maybe I should have made one up. Well, more penalties.
Yeah, I don't think you're the kind of bloke who does like the triple backflip, are you? Or the punching the corner flag or anything like that?
No, or you're allowed to take the shirt off back then as well. So I wasn't. I don't think that was in my nature either.
You've burst onto the scene at a time when Aston Villa are a very good competitive team, you know, pushing for league titles, FA Cup finals. I know that post-Villa you went on and kind of topped up your trophy cabinet, but was there any regrets from that time at Villa that Villa didn't make that extra kick to kind of win something in your early days there?
Yeah, that's my main regret when I talk about my Villa career, really, not just that era, because obviously, the best time was definitely at the beginning, sort of late 90s, early 2000s, and then the last 3 years under Martin O'Neill. So yeah, I'm new to the game. You know, I find myself playing in FA Cup finals. We're top of the league at Christmas. You know, you're thinking this is going to be the norm. We've got a great experienced team here. We've got some young players coming through. You know, Villa can be challenging, but you know, it just shows how quickly football can change. And you know, I had some tougher years, if you like, ahead of me.
What's your memory of the cup final, Gareth, in 2000?
I was on the back of a sort of crazy sort of crazy year, really. I was being talked about getting in the England squad. My confidence was really high. We'd beat Bolton in the semi-final. And, you know, the manager chose me to take a penalty. This was the old Wembley, wasn't it? So that's the faith John Gregory had in me. Yeah, I remember travelling down, thinking, well, this is what you dream of as a child, playing in the FA Cup final at Wembley. You know, you can't really believe it's happening to you at such a young age. We travelled down a couple of days before, stayed in a hotel. John had us doing some sort of group bonding sessions, sort of learning to trust your teammates, if you like. And yeah, it was just a shame that the game was a pretty dull affair if you look back, and unfortunately we were on the end of one mistake and it went against us. So yeah, it was it would have been unbelievable to have lifted the FA Cup with Villa, but unfortunately it didn't happen.
Am I right in thinking that within a week of that cup final, or a couple of weeks, you made your England debut?
Yeah, it was the end of the season. I'm not sure if it was before the cup final or after. I think it was after, actually. There was a couple of friendlies before Kevin Keegan announced the Euro 2000 squad. And, yeah, we played Ukraine. And I was in the squad on the bench. Yeah, I was lucky enough to come on and make my debut at 19 against Ukraine. So, yeah. Proud moment then. Another moment, and if you hear lads speak about it when their first call up comes, you know, I fully understand where they're coming from, you know, your first day at school, if you like, but you know, 10 times worse because you're coming in with some real big characters and fantastic players. And you know, looking back at that squad, Tony Adams, Alan Shearer, David Seaman, you know, there was huge names in the squad. And you know, I was luckily I had Gareth Southgate there with me back then, and you know, he was big for me as a young kid around England, as well as he was at Aston Villa.
You mentioned kind of both ends of your Villa career under John Gregory, when Villa were flying, under Martin O'Neill, when Villa were trying to kind of challenge again. Just briefly, talk us through those kind of years in between. What was it like under Graham Taylor? What's your main memory of playing under Graham?
Well, initially, I think when John Gregory went, I'd sort of fallen out with him. He was... he dropped me from the team for sort of two or three months. We'd sort of had a disagreement. I think that was the moment where he sort of told me I needed to get my shorts dirtier. I wasn't, you know, that's probably where the yellow cards come from, actually. You know, he was saying I was not fancy Dan, but, you know, trying to concentrate on playing with the ball too much from the fence rather than making tackles. So I was out of the team, and you know, unfortunately for John, he ended up leaving, and Graham Taylor come in, and you know, he was great for me personally, because he sort of told me he had a lot of faith in me, and I'd be back in the team before I knew it. And you know, one or two games after his reign, he you know, he brought me back in the fold, and he was a great man, if you like. It was just unfortunate that season the squad probably wasn't good enough to finish any higher than we did, and it was unfortunately a tough year for the team and Graham.
Do you remember, without wishing to kind of open up old wounds, do you remember the kind of, obviously Blues were back in the, yeah, Premier League, weren't they, back then? And there was the old Enkelman at that place, and then there was Dion dropping the nut on Robbie, yeah, Savage back at Villa Park. What was that like to be involved in? From, you know, we saw it from the stands. What was it like to be in the heat of the pitch?
Yeah, it was my first real experiences of you know, having lost the game and not wanting to show my face, if you like, around Birmingham. A lot of my friends are blue noses, and obviously you get the messages before. I just remember the atmosphere at St Andrews that first game where the Enkelman incident happened. It, you know, it was electric. I probably never felt anything like it, if you like. You could feel the hatred between the fans. It was you know, it was a red hot atmosphere. And, you know, we probably took them for granted, if you like. We felt we were Aston Villa, the Premier League team. That's you know, we are a Premier League team. You've just come up from the Championship, but you know, looking back then, they had a great battling squad that had experienced pros that knew how to win a game of football for Steve Bruce. And, you know, we unfortunately came up short. And, yeah, it was a horrible, sickening moments when you lose derby games.
Briefly onto the O'Leary reign. Again, it was probably, you know, there were good moments, I think, but it wasn't it wasn't quite the Villa that we'd come to expect. What was it like? What was that era like for you?
Initially, really good, because for the first time, he come in with Roy Aitken and Steve McGregor, who was his fitness coach. And, you know, first time I see football changing then, it was, you know, fitness was going to be a big part of this squad that he brought in. You know, we were doing runs during the season that were trying to get us fitter. And there was a sort of a professional sort of change, if you like, around Aston Villa, because, you know, you needed to be fit to be in that squad. You couldn't just rely on your ability, if you like. And yeah, initially I really enjoyed playing under, and we played some great football. I think our first win against Birmingham came when David was manager. So going back to that, there was a sweet moment, I think, when Kevin Phillips scored. But eventually we had a bad season under David too. So like you said, there was some very good football in between. The culture sort of started to change a little bit under David at the club. And, unfortunately, the last season didn't go too well.
You'll have to forgive my ignorance or my memory here, Gareth, but who was it who first made you Villa captain?
Yeah, that was David O'Leary. I think it might have been his first game. We went to Portsmouth away, first game of the season. So I was probably 20, 23. Yeah, he makes me captain. We 2-0 down. I think I win a penalty, then score it. Then the adrenaline's high. 5 minutes later, I've said something to the linesman. I've got sent off. So it was, that was my first time as captain, I think, from the start of the game. And not a great start to being a captain of a football club. But again, a learning curve. For my future.
Sorry, I wasn't fishing for that. I didn't realise that.
You knew.
That would have been your first sending off as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. They were they just brought in like real sort of strict rules protecting the referees and linesmen. And, you know, adrenaline got the better of me, and I'd probably hold my hands up and say I shouldn't have said what I said to the linesman back then.
I think that times in your Villa career, I hope I'm fair in saying that you've kind of been one of the outstanding players throughout the time, but there's been differences in the quality alongside you. And I think when O'Neill came in, there was the sense from the fans, at least, that we've got, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 good players who can achieve something. Is that the way it felt for you?
Yeah, we felt unbeatable at times. You know, the way Martin sort of managed his teams, he had his sort of 11, 12, 13 players that he just really installed his belief in. And, you know, you go out against any team believing you could go and win. You know, you go through the team, and, you know, they were top Premier League players that as a team, we were a real solid unit. Great games with great individual performances. But unfortunately, you know, we were just falling short sometimes, and we were desperate to get one of those Champions League places. But it was sort of in an era where it was known as the Big Four, if you like. And, you know, probably now we found a team to break in, but back then they were so strong, they had the Champions League money, and unfortunately we couldn't quite break in, coming very close certain seasons.
What was his style of management like? Because when we've spoken to other people who have played under Martin, we kind of get the sense that you're either really in with the in crowd, proper tight, or I don't know how to put it, but if you're a squad player, probably didn't get the love and attention and opportunities that you perhaps wanted. So you were in with the in crowd. Did he kind of make you feel really a big part of what he was trying to do?
Yeah, to talk about Martin's style, he just kept everything simple. There would have been frustration if he didn't have a belief in you to be in the starting 11. You probably felt you were certainly not part of his plans. You know, he had this thing before games. He pretty much, if there was no injuries, all the lads knew it'd be same team, same subs. He wouldn't even read the names out. we had a period where the lads weren't picking up injuries, and it would be the same team, same subs every week. So yeah, I could feel the frustration from players that weren't getting a game as much. But you know, ultimately, you've got that shirt as a player that are in the starting 11. And, you know, he built so much faith and confidence into players. You know, your Gabbies, Ashley Youngs, and, you know, you could see them thriving from the confidence that Martin O'Neill was giving them, and you know, they were taking their games to incredible levels back then.
So what would have been the standout moment during that part of your career, the goal against Ajax? Or
yeah, I think it's sort of sad that atmosphere that night, European night at Villa Parks, you know, you can't beat them, which if I talk about a game, a one-off to score the winning goal in one of them games against a big club, when I look back at the team, Ajax had them, so many big names went on and had great careers. But unfortunately, that leads on to the end of that European sort of, you know, we didn't take a strong team into Moscow, did we? So it's that would be a standout moment, yeah. But obviously sad when you look back that, you know, a great squad probably gave up a chance of competing further in a great European competition.
With a bit of distance between then and now, what's your take on that? Because as Villa fans, we're probably success starved compared to what we used to get in the 80s and 90s. It felt like a big defining moment that Villa didn't kick on against in that year's UEFA Cup. But when I look back at it, I think the Moscow game was actually the last 32. It wasn't, you know, I think it's sometimes we reinvent it as a semi-final
or something.
Sense amongst the players then that it was a missed opportunity.
At the time, I can't exactly say where we were in the league, but I could only imagine we were flying in the top four. And I sort of understood his reasonings at the time because, you know, he wanted us fresh. We were probably winning regularly. The confidence was high in the league. But certainly looking back now, I felt with the squad we had there, it was probably an opportunity missed because I've always felt, you know, teams should go for trophies, whether it's the League Cup. And yeah, I probably looking back now, I would love to have seen a team go there capable of going through.
Without putting words in your mouth, was it kind of these time kind of things that made you think that perhaps if I do want to win trophies, if I do want silverware, I do want to finish my career with something tangible to show for it, I might have to leave Aston Villa? Is this when your kind of thought processes might have started to form like that? Or
certainly the last 2 years, it was sort of entering my head. You know, I'm getting to my late 20s now. I don't want to go through a career without winning a trophy. Obviously, it's my biggest regret. I didn't do that at Aston Villa. So yeah, it would have started being sort of not just in my head, sort of people around me as well, you know, trying to get into my head saying, you know, it might be time to leave and you've got a better chances winning the trophy elsewhere. So yeah, it would have been the last 2 years at Villa where it would start being thought about.
So okay then, talk us through this this News of the World interview then. What was the thinking there? What's the thinking now?
There was sort of interest from Liverpool in the press. Martin O'Neill knew about it. He was quite clever really. I remember he put me up in front of the press. These are the games that go on in football. I didn't know what was coming. He put me up in front of the press. First question, obviously, what are your thoughts on Liverpool Champions League? Me, never experienced sort of transfer thingy. I've sort of said the right things as you would, that you're it's nice to be in spoke about, et cetera, being linked with a Champions League team. And that was it, really. So I go away, finish the season. You know, there's bids now coming in from Liverpool. I'm speaking to Martin O'Neill. I'm asking what other club going to accept an offer for me. And to be fair to Martin, he said, if the money's right, you can go, but it's got to be a certain amount. And, you know, Liverpool couldn't afford what Villa wanted, which for me, right, fair enough. If they can't afford it, if they can't afford me, then I'm going to carry on playing. But, you know, I got advised to do an interview, which I was told me, if you do something like this, if you try and push, rock the boat, if you like, you'll end up getting yourself out. So me, I remember speaking to my parents saying, what do you think I'll throw him under the bus. My agent said he thinks I should do this interview here. And I remember my parents saying, no, it doesn't sound good. And I was like, well, he's experienced in this role. I've got you don't know what you're talking about. Obviously, you should always listen to your parents. Yeah, I ended up doing that interview, which got me some bad headlines, if you like, and definitely one thing I regret doing.
It seems like a very un-Gareth Barry thing for you to do. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. Looking back now, it was definitely, and you know, you look back and think, oh, why the hell did I do that? But for me, I was in a transfer saga, my first ever experience. My head's sort of frazzled, if you like, because I don't deal with sort of all the media attention too well. It's something I'd rather not have. Yeah, it's one of those things. You got advice to do it. In the end, you go, okay, let's just see what happens from it. And it all gets blown up. And I remember being on holiday with my family, and the phone rings. Martin O'Neill, he's not too happy.
We've all been on the receiving end of an unhappy Martin O'Neill phone call, I can tell you. But didn't you get... You got fined. I think you got stripped of the captaincy. And I think, were you banished to stay away from Bodymore for a couple of weeks as well?
So the phone call came through, and I knew straight away what it was about. But he, to be fair to Martin, he just wanted to know if it was me that said all these things, because he was probably finding it hard to believe that I'd said them. He's thinking, are these quotes from your agent and not you? But, you know, I wasn't going to throw anyone under the bus. Says, look, I've said these I said it's time for me to leave, et cetera, et cetera. And that was it. So thought nothing of it. And then I think I get a letter through the post saying I've been fined 2 weeks' wages, banned from all Aston Villa property for 2 weeks. And, my return date. So that was where I was left, really, in pre-season the next year.
What did you do during those 2 weeks? I mean, there was no Netflix then. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think it was one of those. I just went back, got my head straight. I'd have trained on my own. All I needed to know is that I was going to be playing my football at Aston Villa next year. As soon as I knew that, my head was fine. I'd done the 2 weeks pre-season on my own. Went to training. I said, spoke to Martin O'Neill. He was good. He says, look, do what you do best playing football. As soon as he said that, I was fine. And I think that season, I ended up probably playing my best football for Aston Villa. So it was sort of just got on with it, if you like.
Was there a game, was it Warsaw in pre-season, where you got a bit of stick while it was all still a bit raw with the fans?
Yeah, I think there was possibly a few boos. And you know, for someone I always speak, like I was so experienced in terms of football, but in terms of transfers, I was inexperienced, if you like. So then there was still a learning curve getting booed by my own fans. But no, I remember taking a touch out the air and turning someone and playing a diagonal pass, and I could feel the claps coming back straight away. So I knew, get your head down, give 100%. And I know football fans, that's all they want from their players. So it didn't bother me at all, really.
No, we're an easy bunch to win back over. And like you said, I think that final season, kind of after the emotion and the rawness, I think, I can't speak on behalf of all Villa fans, but certainly in my mind, with the professionalism and the performances you put in, you showed that you were fully committed to Aston Villa through that final year anyway.
Yeah, that was it. I think they appreciate the fact that, you know, they'd have seen other players sulk over the years. They've not got their way. They've spat their dummy out. They're not going to perform. They're not going to give 100%. So that was, you know, that was never in my character, and that was never going to happen. Martin gave the captaincy to Martin Larsson, which, you know, I fully understood. But you know, ended up Martin suffered an injury, and you know, just showed Martin thought of me. He gave it back to me, and as you say, I ended up in my eyes playing some of the best football in my career that season.
The following summer, you did leave the club, and it was Man City. Was the Man City project sold? And as we now know, Man City have gone on to a completely different kind of stratosphere, but is that what kind of excited you and engaged you? Because people were thinking, oh, we could understand you leaving to join Liverpool, but when you left to join Man City, it was almost like a kind of dagger to the heart again, I think.
Yeah, well Martin O'Neill, he said, give me a year and then you can leave for a certain fee. So, you know, that was all fine. I knew probably in my heart that I was going to leave that summer. But yeah, the whole Liverpool thing was, it sort of hurt. It hurt me that they couldn't stump up the money the season before. And then a couple of phone calls with Rafa, where he was talking about me playing the odd game left midfield, the odd game left back. My head started to change thinking, you know, I'm not giving up sort of a Villa captaincy playing regularly to go and do that, if you like. I don't care if it's Champions League. I don't want to be a bit part of nothing. And then from nowhere, if you like, Man City got in touch, started speaking about certain players they were on about signing, which even then was hard to believe. But you know, they put the names down in front of me, said they were definitely going for these, and you know, they sort of painted the picture that this is a fast train. You know, if you don't get on it, you're gonna regret it. So, yeah, something appealed to me a bit more to Man City than Liverpool at the time. And Liverpool had won the Champions League not so long ago. Man City hadn't won the trophy for many a years, and I went with that route rather than the other one.
So, tell us about the letter that you sent, because I think you used to get on quite well with my former colleague Bill Howell. And I think you got a letter. In the Birmingham Mail, didn't you? Just address the fans. What was your thinking behind that?
Yeah, I just wanted to let them know my thoughts, really, and thank them for the previous 12 years. It wasn't an easy decision. Just to let them know, and you know, sort of put the thing to bed. But I think it went down well in some parts, but in football, these football fans, they don't want their best players leaving, and unfortunately the majority probably didn't take it too well at that time.
I think you've been a bit harsh there. I think it was a nice gesture, and I think it was quite well received, to be honest. The fact that you've gone to that trouble to send it. I won't dwell on that much more, and I won't keep you a great deal longer because you've been brilliant with your time. I was going to ask about that first return to Villa Park because, it's football fans being football fans, but there were kind of, I think people printing off banknotes with your face on and all that kind of thing. By that stage, Gareth, and having come through the booing at Walsall and emerged through the other side, and having this in your character that you're a fairly laid-back kind of guy, was that something you were able to just kind of roll with, or did that kind of give you a little bit of a jolt given the service that you'd given Villa?
I know there wasn't a majority of people, and it only takes one photo, doesn't it, to paint a picture sometimes. It does hurt. But on the other side of it, I took it that, just shows what, for it to hurt the club that much, it shows what they thought of me as well. So I didn't always put a negative spin on that. That first game was definitely the toughest sort of I played in, because my head was probably thinking of other things rather than the game that day. And no one likes to be getting criticised, but that was my first time back. I'll think of the last time I played in front of the fans at Villa Park, where playing for a rival team, West Brom. We've won the game sort of 2-0, and when I've come off, and to get a standing ovation from the fans, that's for me, which is what I'll leave in my head in terms of myself and Villa fans.
I think that's the fitting send off, really. It's probably the send off that you I don't know whether testimonials are still a thing in this day and age, but it was probably the kind of testimonial moment, really. I know it's only you're playing in the colours of a rival, and you give it a proper beating that day, but it's kind of the moment that you deserved, I think. Just a couple more minutes, and then I'll let you get on with your day, although you're in lockdown, so
I've got too much else to do.
Just a couple of quickfire things. Favourite goal that you scored for Villa?
I think it's the best goal I've scored in my career. It was my right foot against Spurs. We were 1-0 down, and the Harden Villa fans will remember it. I've cut in a couple of players and curled it around Paul Robinson, so I choose that one.
You can't score many with your right, can you?
You'll be surprised. There'll be a few.
We spoke to Lee Hendry probably a couple of months ago at the start of the first lockdown and asked him the question. And I won't ask you the question of your paycheck every week of your career, but can you remember what your first paycheck was and what you spent it on?
Well, I think you sign your first professional contract at 17 because you're not allowed to. So by now, I've been training at the club for 7 months and, you know, I've done really well playing reserve team football. So this was probably the first awkward moment with me and Michael Standing. He'd signed a professional contract before we got there and I just signed the YTS terms. So I'd hit the ground running. They offered me a contract and I come home to the digs and he says, oh, what did they get? And so I've told him, £600 and £60,000 signing on fee. And he's like, I said, is that good? What did you get? And he pretty much said, I doubled everything I've got. And I was like, oh, that was the first awkward moment with me and Michael. But yeah, I would have been learning to drive 17. So I think that money would have gone towards my first car, which would have been a Renault Megane. So it would have gone towards that.
Again, without prying too much, Lee Hendry was talking about back in the day, kind of Studebakers and Liberties and places like that. What would have been your kind of hangout when you could have got away with it without the gaffer knowing?
Yeah, we'll go into Lee. But in that dressing room, which we mentioned earlier, I leave so much credit for taking me under his wing, if you like, because, you know, being in that dressing room with all the older pros and the big names, he was the one that really looked after me. And, you know, if anyone would come for me for a bit of stick, he'd have had my back. And, yeah, going back to your question of the hideouts, you know, it was Lee that showed me the ropes. You know, I'd never been to a nightclub in my life. Obviously, wasn't old enough growing up in Hastings. And Lee pretty much showed me top to bottom of Broad Street within a few months. So I think pretty much everywhere, any bar on Broad Street would have hit at some point. But Studebakers, looking back, would have been the place we'd have spent most of our time. Seemed to have a good few nights over the years there. It's plenty different for a young footballer now than it was back then. You could certainly get away with a lot more then.
Can you imagine? I think if my memory serves me correctly, Connor, Lee Hendry used to be the one who'd sneak his way onto the front pages, and you'd be quite good at sneaking staying under the radar and staying on the back pages.
Yeah, I sort of got that reputation of you know, fading away sometimes when trouble was lurking. And unfortunately for Lee, which for me was because he was a local lad, everyone wanted a bit of Lee, which was unfortunate. And I'd put my cloak on and fade away into the background.
So without wishing to go on too much about that, what would your tipple have been back then and now?
Oh, blooming hell. So you'd been looking, we'd have been young kids then. We weren't about the mature taste of a lager. We would have been drinking Smirnoff Ice, WKD.
Little Moscow Mule. Like that.
I think we slowly matured over the years, but that would have been my first memory of any alcohol in a nightclub in Birmingham.
Tell me you're not still drinking Hooch and Smirnoff Ice now. You must have matured your palate by now.
Yeah, no, I don't think I ever experienced the Hooch, but yeah, no, there's certainly no none of that in the fridge in the kitchen at the moment.
Just while you're at Villa, Gareth, and you said Lee Hendry initially, but who would have been your kind of best mate or your mentor or your closest ally during, you know, you're probably there for over a decade, 12 or 13 years. Who would you have been closest to throughout that time?
Definitely Lee Hendry. I've spoken about the way he sort of took me under his wing and, you know, still really close to him like now, but until he left, we were best mates of the club, so he would definitely have been my best mate on the pitch. You know, I probably have to give Gareth Southgate the sort of mentoring role, because a young boy thrown into Premier League football, you need good players around you, and certainly Gareth Southgate playing just to the left of him for the first couple of seasons, he was incredible to play alongside, and, you know, pretty reassuring if you made mistakes you know, you wouldn't be sort of the old style pro that would get on you and, you know, be wringing your neck. He would calm you down and just say, you know, be ready. Don't make that mistake again. He'd do it in the way that, you know, made you feel comfortable. So he was perfect for a young kid to be playing alongside back then.
Can I make an observation based on watching you for many years from the Holt end and then from the press box?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a footballer who is as calm in possession anywhere at any time. It's just almost as if kind of everything stops for you. And I've seen you kind of extricate your way out of, there's been three or four people around you near the touchline and you've somehow emerged with a ball and stuff. You know, you've spoken about nervous energy and adrenaline, but you seem to have this kind of way of just kind of flicking a switch and just kind of slowing everything down. Is that just natural, or?
I think it's got to be a number of things, if you like. It's got to be part of your personality. I'm quite a calm person. But yeah, I've always sort of, one of my strengths as a footballer was sort of taking early pictures on the pitch, or, you know, never switching off, you know, just being aware of your surrounding and who's around you. And you've mentioned times where you can bring the ball down, and that comes with confidence as well. You've got to be in a confident moment. But yeah, it's probably down to my nature and being able to read the game. You know, it's been said to me many a times about my pace. So, you try and make up your other strengths to coincide with that. And, you know, reading the game was certainly something that came natural to me.
Is there any time in life that you do lose your calm? You know, if the pasta's boiling over, or there's a massive spider in the bath or anything like that?
Yeah, there's plenty of stories in this house where I'm living now. They'll say I lose my calm. So
that's probably
on the
been
football
a pitch,
you can relax a bit more.
And another thing that's probably kind of followed you through your career, seemed to have kind of clocked up lots and lots of yellow cards. Now, I know that comes with the amount of games that you've played, but lots of yellow cards without ever really being what I'd describe as a dirty player. Is that just, I don't know, what is that just a victim of playing so often?
I think obviously they'll come with the number of games that I played. You obviously, you know, top up numbers. But I think if you look at probably the first 50% of my appearances, the yellow cards will be very low. I just feel the game changed. It got very quicker. You know, as you know now, you can get a yellow card for hardly anything. And being in the area of the pitch I am, centre midfield, you know, stopping counter-attacks, you just got to take one for the team now and again. And it just seemed to be my way to take one for the team more often than not.
There's something I wanted to ask you about, and it's a bit of a random moment. But just, do you remember your role as peacekeeper in the old Lee Bowyer, Kieran Dyer spat? Well, yeah. That must have been one of the most surreal afternoons of your career.
Yeah, it was. Obviously, that's like a mad Premier League moment that comes up all the time, and it will do forever. And so to talk about it from my point of view, I think we were winning the game at the point, maybe 1-0. But they were arguing while the game was going on for at least sort of 45 seconds to a minute before. And I'm trying to concentrate on the game whilst sort of listening to these two. So I could feel it getting heated and heated, and some of the things being said they were saying to each other wasn't sort of normal. When you can tell it was going to bubble over. So yeah, I'm trying to keep half an eye on the game, whereas half an eye on these two, and then all of a sudden they're walking towards each other, and I'm thinking they're just going to have a chat or a push, but then the punches start getting thrown, and you know, luckily I'm close enough by to try and break it up. So yeah, I find myself in a lot of pictures over the years breaking that title up every time it's spoken about.
So as a captain, you know, take us inside the dressing room. Are you somebody who has to kind of put an arm around people? Do you have to have a rant and a rave? Do you collect the fines? Are you the shop steward? Are you all of those things? Or?
You have to step yourself up when you're asked to be a captain of a club. There's you seem to be doing every other interview. That's the first thing you'll be doing. The fines, you're in charge of those. Obviously, you're setting the right example around for every player, not just the younger players. Giving tickets out, that was probably one of my worst things being captain. Gabby Agbonlahor winning 10 tickets every game where we're only getting two each was one of my worst nightmares.
It must have been super, super proud, though.
Yeah, I was. I was extremely proud of captaining Aston Villa. You know, I'd captained other teams when I had left, but, you know, I was never an official club captain like I was at Aston Villa. And, you know, those 3 years under Martin O'Neill was special in my career and possibly some of the best football I played.
But putting you on the spot here, what's been the funniest moment or funniest prank that you've been part of or witnessed during your time at Villa?
It's the old favourite, really, when a car gets removed from the, I think it was maybe Stefan Posmar, Lee Hendry's, he's in the shower. Lee's managed to get hold of his car keys and probably moved his car onto the main road. Everyone's gone home and Stefan's left at the training ground not knowing where it is. So that one strings to mind.
Some people react better to these things than others. Who, you know, was the one who was kind of easy prey for these kind of things? Who was kind of particularly Mardy, yeah. If you kind of wound him up?
There's definitely easy targets in dressing rooms and unfortunately they're the ones that took most of the stick, and obviously Stefan Posmar was one of them.
What would be your kind of absolute most memorable moment at Villa, whether it's a good or a bad, it's a result, it's something bizarre that's happened? What would the most vivid thing that stands out in your mind from your time at the club?
I think that Ajax game, you know, European nights, that's what the fans want to be seeing. We were playing in a great team, against a great team, and to score the winning goal in that game was certainly a moment that sticks with me.
Before we leave you to go on your way, what is it you're up to now here that you're playing a bit of cricket, aren't you, for your local village team?
Yeah, so obviously not at the moment with the winter coming, but through the summer, yeah, it's a sport I used to love at school and, you know, didn't play for 20 odd years. So something I've started getting back into over the summer. So, yeah, looking forward to that starting again next year. I was more of a bowler at school, but coming to the all-rounder category now.
Are you one of these blokes who's annoyingly good at everything in terms of sport?
No, terrible at tennis. Terrible at tennis.
I saw a clip of you. You've got a decent darts game, haven't you? I saw a clip of you playing Everton.
Yeah, I used to play a lot of darts. Probably not a good sign, that, is it? Being a pub game. But yeah, I used to go to the pub with my dad a lot.
So outside of cricket, Gareth, have you got coaching ambitions? I've seen you do a bit of punditry, or are you just kind of enjoying taking a step back and having family time for the foreseeable? Or what's the plan, I suppose, is a big open question.
At the minute, just certainly the dust is settling and getting used to my own time. Coaching, it's not jumping out of me at the minute. I'd never say never, because, you know, opportunities can arise and all of a sudden you can choose that road. But yeah, I'd say I'm more likely to be doing more media than coaching, but you never know. But yeah, certainly letting the dust settle at the moment from retirement, because it was a great 20 so years playing professional football.
There's been a bit of water under the bridge now. You've had a great career with Aston Villa. I think I'm right in saying that you're Villa's record Premier League appearance maker, and I'm not sure that's going to be broken anytime soon. What's your message for Villa fans?
No, they know I love Aston Villa. You know, you don't spend 12 years at a club and not care about something. And, you know, if I'm put on the spot and I have to choose one of my previous clubs, then Villa comes out on top.
Ah, brilliant. Listen, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I think I can speak on behalf of Villa fans that you're going to go down as one of the kind of greats. And the fact that you're a brilliant footballer and a thoroughly nice bloke as well, it's been brilliant to spend time in your company. And yeah, good luck with lockdown. Have a great Christmas. And yeah, I hope 2021's good for you and the family as well. Thanks for joining us, mate.
No worries, Matt. Great speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to Claret and Blue, an Aston Villa podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, then please let us know. We love hearing your feedback. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, up the Villa!